So, welcome everyone to today's virtual machines lecture. Last time we talked about a little bit more of control structures. So we had statements like the if branch, the while loop, the switch, and the for loop. And we have also talked a little bit about extending our so far quite limited understanding of what values can be to arrays and structs. And this is, I think, where we left off last time. So let's have a look at what comes next. So the next thing we need to talk about is the way that dynamic memory works. And this brings us into the area of pointers and dereferencing and allocating memory and all that. So that's going to be quite interesting. So if we now introduce things like pointers, we can't generally tell anymore that our access to the memory will be described by a principle like this LIFO. Instead, with pointers, we can just access memory in an arbitrary way. So usually for that, it's not sufficient to keep the data just on the stack anymore, but instead what we want is some data structure for arbitrary access of data, and that is what we introduce here with the general purpose storage area, the so-called heap. And for that, we introduce another accessor to our memory, this H thing, which is the heap for our purposes. And often in implementations, you see that in terms of partitioning memory, you'll see that on one side of the memory, you allocate the memory for the stack part of the virtual machine. And on the other side, you see the part that deals with the heap. And this begins at maximum address, and it's going to be giving us addresses that are decreasing bit by bit as we allocate more memory for our dynamic data structures. So in order to now do something useful with that, we now introduce further registers that we use to access this heap area in some way. So for one, there is the new pointer, which is kind of delimiting the boundaries of the area that we consider to be belonging to the heap. So this usually points to the lowest cell that is still occupied in some way by a malloc. This is, comes quite naturally. What you might be surprised to find here is this EP, the extreme pointer. This is kind of a safety thing that we introduce here. This is the uppermost cell to which the stack pointer can actually grow when executing our current program. Well, this will be this will going to be precise into executing the actual current function. But for our purposes, it's, well, we will have to execute some kind of algorithm by just continuing with our program counter. And during this execution, when evaluating expressions, for example, we will encounter the need for allocating space on the stack. And this extreme pointer gives us a pointer to the maximum address that we're going to touch during this evaluation of expressions during that time. Why is that a good thing? Well, yes?
Why is it called new pointer?
Because that is, maybe more obvious when we continue on in the lecture, since we will introduce an instruction that's called new, which will, for our purposes, then allocate memory. But yeah, that's behind that. But anyway, so this, in principle, what's going to happen is that both stack and heap may grow during the run of the program. For once, the program will execute functions, will put stack frames on the stack, that's growing the stack. Also, it will evaluate expressions, also allocating space on the stack, so the stack will grow for sure. Also, heap objects might be allocated during the run of our program, which will step by step also grow the area that the heap is going to occupy. So both of them are growing, and they are organized in a way that they grow in direction of each other. So at some point, they're going to, or they might, collide or overlap at some point. And that is then the situation that we all know and like best. That is the stack overflow. So in order to make sure that something like this does not happen unnoticed, we introduce this EP, this extreme pointer, that is, we said that it would point to the uppermost cell that might be touched during evaluation of the current stack frame. And what you can assume for now is that is this is a thing that we can, when we start to execute a particular function, we will know how to, or we know from the compiler how many stack cells are actually going to be used for that particular function frame. So we can initiate initialize this extreme pointer appropriately, relative to the stack pointer, of course. So that when we allocate heap, we can always check when we allocate more heap, because we're going to allocate by decreasing the heap point or the new pointer. We can at some point check whether the new pointer is actually pointing to a smaller address than the extreme pointer, and that is the situation where both areas would grow into each other, which would then tell us that now it's actually a stack overflow. Okay. So, what can we do with pointers in general? So, we have already had a little bit of discussions about that particular topic, one of the last lectures. Well, first of all, of course, we want to be able to somehow set the pointer to a storage cell, so we somehow store the address of that particular cell, or we want to dereferentiate a pointer. So we that is because we want to access the value in the storage cell that's pointed to by a pointer. And, well, for our purposes, we introduce, in order to handle the introduction of new dynamic memory into the system, and translation scheme for the malloc operator, that is the C interface to allocating new memory on the heap. And for that, what we do is, well, usually we need to allocate as much memory as this expression evaluates, what you find in the brackets. So we generate code that evaluates this expression, and then issue a new virtual machine instruction that we call new, that handles the updates to the management registers and all that. We're going to see how this works later on. Then the other big thing that we want to have is now that we want to somehow access addresses of storage cells in order to store them into pointers at some point. So that is done by handling the address of operator in expressions. So that is a thing that you see over here, this address of operator is, well, kind of directly translatable by just switching over to our alternative evaluation mode that gives us the left-hand side code generation for expressions, which kind of automatically is the address of particular expressions. So some of them have an L value, some don't, but depending on the compiler has checked for correctness of the program, this will usually work out fine. So maybe just quick notice, this address of operator in that sense is just a switch between the code generation functions. There's no additional execution necessary on the virtual machine itself, so that is a thing that doesn't need any particular further semantics definitions. Instead, what actually needs semantics is the new operator, or the new instructions. And this is a thing that emanates from machine state, where on top of the stack there is a value that came evaluated by whatever the evaluation of the E parameter of the malloc gave. And this is the number of cells that need to be allocated on the heap. So it's about these n cells. And the new instruction, what it does is it conceptually adds these n cells to the heap by decrementing the new pointer by n, if everything goes right, and pointing to the start of this area from the top of the stack cell, while at the same time removing the old value that gave us the size of the heap object. This is what happens as long as everything works well, and this is what you see happening in this part of the semantics. So, as I said, this happens if everything works well. What can go wrong? Well, we said that there's this notion of stack overflow that happens whenever the new pointer and the extreme pointer overlap. And that is the thing that you see handled in the virtual machine part over here. So this tries out whether this number that is stored on top of the stack subtracted from the new pointer, meaning that the new pointer is kind of already grown, is already smaller than the extreme pointer. This is the situation where they have collided and the two areas have grown into each other. And in that case, the memory will not be allocated. Instead, we will return some whatever the standard for C says, and in that case, this will just return the integer constant 0, encoded as null here, to notify the user that there is no heap memory, no dynamic memory left. Yeah.
So that means that our machine does not actually crash, but rather we have an error value that can then maybe catch and do things with it, or is that the idea?
So in that situation here, we don't need to crash. We can still continue to work, but we, the user must take care that now he has a null pointer in the system, which is equally malicious.
Okay, but if we don't crash at this point, we probably crash later if we try to use that null pointer or something.
Yeah, if you don't take care of what you got back from this, then you will probably crash.
Okay.
Yeah. Also, there might be other situations in future where it's not the heap that actually grows, but the stack that grows. Just giving a slight hint, method call or function call or procedure call, where we might not be able to call that function. And I'm not sure right now what the reaction to that is, but that might be maybe the crash. So yeah, this is so much for the stack heap overlapping. So now dereferentiation of pointers. So there's the evaluation operator, the little star that we can apply to some expression to return the contents to the contents of a storage cell whose address is the R value of E, it says here. So this is quite closely related already to what the semantics of this thing is. So applying this operator again is an operation with just no semantics on the virtual machine, but switching between the two code generation modes. And this time now we go from address code generation to value code generation. So from code L to code R. And just continue with the evaluation of the expression itself. So from L to R, and other than that, there's no semantics to that. But that already gives us quite a few tools to use and to translate more complicated expressions. So, for example, we have the following situation. We have declarations of kind of complicated types, like this struct thingy T that has two accessors A and B, with A being an array of size 7 and B being a pointer to, well, again, a structure T. So maybe remembering recalling what we have done last time for structs, you might recall that these accessors there can be found again in, well, structure-specific environments that we can access during code generation. So there's this row parameterized with the actual structure type. From there we can obtain offsets of these accessors within the data structure. So we can query for A and B in there. And the actual offset will be compile time constant, but depending on the way that these things have actually been declared. And more specifically, the offsets of some accessor AI is depending on the sizes of all the data types of the accessors before. So this offset for B is depending on the size of the array A that we find before that. So just to reestablish that in our minds. So what else do we have? We find that there's simple variables I and J, and we also have a name for that is declared as the type T, or pointer to type T. So let's have a look at what we actually want to generate code for, and that would be this complicated bugger. And that is now nested code thing, and also has operators that we haven't seen so far, which are these nice little arrows. But for our purposes, this arrow is no different than the successive use of two already known operators, so this arrow thing can be replaced by dereferentiation and access to the struct. So what would the code for such a thing then look like? Well, this arrow operator then is, well, this is going to consist in the dereferentiation of the pointer, which is in itself just calling the right-hand side code generation function on the expression E. So that's what we're going to do first. So this treats that part over here. And the access to some accessor is in that sense just, well, first of all, we need the offset into the data structure. So that is something that we look up with this row T of the accessor A. We do that at compile time, so we can just obtain a number that we can then feed into this generation of the load C. And with that, well, we just have to merge them together, which is done by the ordinary add thing, and with that we get the address that we're supposed to get for the code L thing. Okay, so it's just those two things together. So maybe to give you the picture of what we are dealing with when we want to generate code for this PTINJ variable thingy together with the expression, that would be this nice picture over here. So we have the PT pointer and INJ. INJ are simple data types, so those two are just plain stack variables. This PT is a pointer, and that is stored on the stack. And let's have a look back what this PT is actually defined as. That is a pointer to a struct of that form. So that is what this thing will point to. It will point to a structure that contains two offsets A and B, whereas the A part is an array of size 7. So that's going to be one of these buggers. And then there's a pointer to another structure T, which is kept in a single cell, in this case not on the stack, but on in the heap, since we are or potentially in the heap, at least some memory area that we point to. And yeah, this will point to another, well, of type this one, so we repeat the whole thing like this again over here. This potentially continues on as long as the pointer part is actually pointing to a valid address. So this is conceptually the situation which we are in before we start evaluating the expression. So I think to make it a little bit easier to follow, I can show this graphics over here so that we can keep it in mind while we do the actual translation. So, or even, I don't know, do you prefer the type declaration or the graphical representation? I don't know. Type graphical thing? Okay. So, let's keep that here. So, for our example, let's assume the following address environment. So, row is evaluating I to 1, J to 2, and the pointer to 3. And we have a T address environment looking like, well, as it should do, A points to the beginning of the struct, and B points right behind the its previous accessor, and the size of the previous accessor was 7 integers, so should start at offset 7. Okay, so let's have a look how this should actually then work. The expression to translate is code L for this one over here, which is then, well, the outermost thing which matches with our code generation patterns is the array access one, probably. So this will keep these parts unevaluated so far and delegate them to the code generation for, well, for one the arrow expression thingy, and for the other part the index expression, And in order to connect them to each other, what needs to be done is we need to then determine the actual size of the array. This is given to us by looking at the type of the expression for the actual array pointer part. And this gives us that the size of the array cells will be 1. So that is one thing that we have to generate. Then there's a multiplication with the actual index. So this couples these things together. So with that, we have multiplied the size of the arrays with the actual index expression. And this is then going to be added to the start address of the array, which is given to us by this expression. And this bundles those together with the add and the actual address where the index points to. So this still leaves room for code generations for the array address part and the index part. The index part, well, that is one that is not so difficult. That is just a plain integer arithmetics and will lead us to, well, we need to generate at first I's address and load from there, which is load A. Then we have the constant 1 and add them together, and this gives us the code that evaluates I plus 1. So far, so good. So all we need to do now is generate the right-hand side code for the array address expression. And this one, then, well, what is done in there? Let's have a look. This is the, at first, the outermost expression that we need to generate code for is this one over here, which is translated as, well, adding the actual offset address of A to the underlying address there, and the offset address of A was, you've seen that, 0. So this will generate this load C0, and this has to be added to whatever the value for this part will give. So let's have a look at what this inner part actually will be generated and into, and that is, well, this is again the same arrow operator, which is again an add. Well, we don't have an actual code R code generation scheme for the arrow operator, but what we have is a generic way of going from code L code to code R code by just adding a little load at the end. So that is what we're going to do now. With that, we can just reuse the code L pattern for that thing. And this is then resulting in whatever this arrow is translated to, particularly with this B, it will be translated to this load C7, and the add to the base expression. The base expression here is just a plain variable, which we can look up, which was the 3 thing over here, that we can fill in there. So load A 3, load C 7 for the B, then we add them together, and we dereferentiate to look up what we got from there to make sure that this arrow is interpreted correctly. Then continue with load and load C, add again. So all in all, if you put that together, what we get is the instruction sequence from down there. So this has the sequence here connected with the sequence from over there. Okay, so that was a little larger example. So as a conclusion, we have now seen a lot of different code generation schemes for expressions and a few statements. And I can imagine that people get a little lost on the way. So what you usually do, even if you work that field a bit more, is that you, in that sense, just gather the actual code generation functions in one central place and keep them there as a kind of a dictionary in order to look up what the different code generation schemes look like. So that's what we have started in this conclusion part. So this is just a tabulation of the so far known code generations for expressions. So what we have is we have a lot of code L code generation schemes. So the code L for the array expression goes this way, what you see here. There's the access to a struct. That is this part. We have code L for an evaluation operator, which is pretty easy. Then there's the code L for a variable, which will just load the address from the address environment. There's a code R for the address operator, which is just switching to code L. There's a code R, this general purpose code R on arbitrary expressions, which will just switch over to code L thing. Then there's code R for your arithmetic binary operations or Boolean binary operations, and this will just delegate to the parameters and use the instruction itself. And then there's the constants, for which we don't have an L value, but only an R value code generation scheme, like directly loading the constant. We have the assignment, which is just code R and code L combined with a store. And we have the code R that we can, in a kind of generic way, obtain from code generation schemes for the L value and then just put load in there. So that is what we have so far. And in order to use them in later examples, we can just switch between them on this side of the screen. Because we're going to tackle a few larger examples now. So this is another one. Just a little bit more complicated. So for that we have the following declaration. We have an array of size 10 of integers, and this nice fellow over here. So maybe the C enthusiasts here can translate for the non-C enthusiasts what this actually declares. Anyone in here who knows what this thing is in plain English? Do you actually know C, or are you all coming from directly from Introduction to Computer Science with Java? No idea? Well, it's probably always a question of what binds stronger than the other operator, isn't it? So the question here is probably, is it an array of pointers or is it a pointer to an array? So those in favor of array of pointers? And what did I say? Pointer of arrays or array of
array.
And pointer of arrays? Okay. So for those things, usually you can ask a little program called cdecl, which will usually give you in plain English the actual description of what such a thing is. So for people like me who are kind of an alphabet in C programming, those people really like these kinds of things. So let's have a look what that actually gives us. Syntax error, nice. I thought it would directly give us that. Maybe I forgot how that actually really worked. Is it like this? Whoa, how nice. I have to look up how that actually really works. This is just a spontaneous thing. But usually this should work. It's on a file, really? Maybe you can try that somehow offline and tell me how to use the syntax if you figure that out, because I think doing that live here is probably a little bit too much. But in fact, there are these helper tools that should give you these translations from the... do we have it? So how do I have to put it in? I somehow... Oh, okay. This would have been the other solution, going online. I'm one of those people who are not native internet people, so this probably... Okay, so like this? So let's try it out. That looks funny to use. So, int, like this, and then, clear, these are pointer to array of integers. Okay, so I actually don't know why my program didn't really, or my command line didn't really work out, but in principle, it should give you the same thing, plain English descriptions of what these things are. So there's helpers for that for people like me who don't actually really speak C. So these are pointer to an array of integer. Okay, so that gives us the binding of that thing. Okay, so now that it's not magic anymore for everyone, we can maybe have a look at what we can do with these things. So, let's have a look at example statements. So, there's this one over here. So this doesn't even use the complicated type that we have deciphered a few moments ago, but still it's a little bit interesting because it now has a left-hand side which is not just a variable without anything else. So let's have a look at what we have to do for that. For that we maybe need a little bit of a reminder of how to treat that. So there's the code L necessary for the pointer to a variable, and what that is it's just the code R for what is supposed to be a pointer, and this is then in that sense again the code L for A, because there's for pointers we can directly do that, and this will give us the evaluation of the name in the environment, which is given here as 7. So this is the address supposed to be associated with this A thing. So that is what code L is all about. Now let's have a look at the code generation for the assignment. This one over here. And the assignment was usually, well, let's have a look at how assignments looked like. So the assignment would first of all generate the code R for the right-hand side. So it's code R for this one, which is the load C of 5, not so difficult. And then there's the code L for the left-hand side. So that is why we are given this code generation scheme here, which right at the end will evaluate to code L of A, and we have already created that for this pointer or this evaluation of A operator, and this gives us load C, which we put in there, and the store will then put the value 5 into address 7, and since we use all of that in the context of an expression statement, we have to now get rid of our intermediate result by adding a pop. So that is something that we haven't had on these things because that is a statement thingy, but you could continue this list depending on how eager you are. I think in the end of this part of the lecture, we will even give out a kind of brochure with all the translation schemes in one place, so you don't have to do that by yourself. But if you like to work for the tutorial, you might be interested in something like that. So we can then continue for an exercise that is a little bit more tricky. So we now actually make use of this type for B, and we specifically look at the statements. B is assigned the expression over here, and the second statement that we look at is that 5 is assigned to an address given by that nice little fellow. So this could look a little bit more complicated, and it actually, I didn't put any in-between steps in there, so this is kind of a... It's not so nice to explain it like this. And there's not a lot of space here. How do we do that? We may do something. No matter how you put it, that's silly to do online, I would say. We can talk about the crucial bits in there, but I don't think that it's really feasible with that amount of space to really work on that. So what you need for that is then the code generation for assignments in both cases, which also it's assignment statements. So the frame for that is usually this pop and store thingy. So these are the two parts that you need for both of these statements. The left one has what is this? The B has a more complicated type, but all we said that this is a pointer type, which is the outermost type for that thing. So this is kind of you can obtain an address for that. Then there is the right-hand side for this, which is the outermost thing, is just an addition. So this is just consisting in loading a constant and evaluating the first operand, which is by itself then just the address of a particular thing, which is the address of this A, which goes to 7 apparently. So this is something that we should find in there somehow directly. Then what else is there? The +2 on the... I think this goes into the expression evaluation for the array index thing, because the arithmetic on arrays is like you have to multiply with the size of the base thing. But I'm not really sure whether this is anchored into... I'm not particularly sure whether this is a very nice example, actually. This is kind of mean. Well, the thing is, we said that there's this load of 2 and the load of the base address like this, which you find in this load C7 and load C2. However, the thing is that this thing is of type array. So this points to arrays now. And from a typing perspective, you then, adding 2, you have to keep in mind that you're going steps of the size of the array by itself. So usually this would rather, I would rather like that to be covered in the code generation scheme that we find here for the array access, where we actually have defined that we want to load with the size of the base pointer and then multiply before doing the actual addition to the base pointer. So I don't know why that is making this nasty thing of addition being overloaded for pointer types explicit in here. Because that's not really covered in the scheme that you see over here. So this is kind of I don't like how this is designed. Anyway, what you would need to do is this multiplication of the base type, because this is the thing. And usually, I would like to see an array index expression if you drive the student into this kind of thing. But oh well, yeah. Anyway, what we need... Yeah?
But isn't A the pointer to the first element of the array? So wouldn't dereferencing just give the value of the first element, or what?
The value, yes, but from a typing perspective, this is still... if you don't put the actual index of the first thing in there, the type of that thing is still the type of the complete array. And thus adding this 2 thing would then go these large steps.
Oh, okay.
And that is why this is so ugly to really talk about without having talked about the plus thing being dependent on the typing of these things. So I'm not particularly happy with how the flow of these slides is for that particular example. That's what happens when you inherit slides from someone else. Yeah. So I don't know what Helmut's purpose was by driving you right into this trap. I would have done that differently, but in principle, we would have to talk about how to interpret pointer types in the context of addition beforehand. And I think this has not been done intensively. Sorry. So maybe just skip that for a little bit later on. I will try to talk to Helmut what he actually wanted to do with that thing. Anyway, so after that very successful example, let's have a look at what other topics are there about memory. Particularly, we had so far talked about dereferentiation and creating new pointers and obtaining pointers from existing L value carrying elements of the language. What else could be said to that is that there's of course the matter of dealing with more and more memory consumption. And usually what you would like to do is keep the memory that you occupy as little as possible, particularly since there's the there's in the language or in the Haskell language the possibility to again free parts of the memory that you don't need anymore, and for that we need to talk about how to free the occupied storage in the virtual machine by itself. So one of the things that is out there is the matter of fragmentation. So you, in the course of the program running, you will split the memory into small pieces that are by themselves well, the size of each of those is motivated by the actual size of the data elements that they have been associated with beforehand. But it turns out that when you start freeing them again, in principle, you still at first keep them in their original size, but you might want to unify those chunks of unused memory again to be able to offer larger fractions of memory again for further use. So there's this this process of defragmentation that is a matter in freeing the occupied storage. Also, there's this idea of pointers still pointing to data structures that have been already freed by the user, which will create these dangling references and has to be somehow dealt with. For our purposes, we have some kind of simplistic solutions to that, because for these the matters of free memory, there's a whole lot of different techniques. It's an active area of research even, where there are several propositions of how to deal with that. For our purposes, we trust the programmer to use this malloc and free in a meaningful way, so that you don't run into this dangling references thing, which might be a naive approach, but still an approach. And in case of memory consumption, we just say, well, for our purposes, we don't really care about the about really freeing examples. It's just a toy language anyway, and the examples won't grow too large. So for our purposes, the code 3 thing will lead to, well, we would just ignore whatever pointer is expected to be freed, so we just pop the value away. But anyway, what we have to do is we have to somehow generate code for the evaluation of the expression to the right of the free operator in order to, well, this thing might have side effects, and if it has side effects, it might write into some variable or call something or do any funky thing that you could imagine. We still have to treat that. So that's why we still perform a code generation for the actual expression. So for our purposes, this will still fulfill the specification of the program. It's just very wasteful with memory. And, well, you could imagine a more intelligent memory management, but that's not really the core topic of this lecture. So that's where we keep it. There's other lectures that should give you more insights into these matters. So the next big thing that we need to talk about is what we have so far left off for so long, which is the functions. And, well, what are functions from our point of view? Well, first of all, we keep functions by a name on the high-level language. And with this name, we can then refer to this function. We can call it. We can even create a pointer to that particular function and pass it around in our program. Anyway, the name is something that we need to deal with. Then we have function specifications. In function specifications, there is usually the header of a function, which when it is present alone, is, let's say, it's called a prototype. And in the specification, we have also the definition of the formal parameters of that particular function. So formal parameters are a matter that we have to deal with. Functions also are defined with a possible result type or void if they don't have any such thing. And usually they also come with a block that contains sequence of statements. So this is the body of the function that needs to be brought to execution at some point. So these are the elements that make the definitions of functions for us. And of course there's also the actual calls later on in the program, which are not really part of the specification, but also belong to the functions. So, in C, we said that we can whenever we meet the or mention the name of a function in some expression or something, we when we need to generate R code for the function, we will consider that this function, when it is translated to program code, at some point will get a start address with which we can later on then call this function, and the R value of the function name then is just a load of that constant. This is something that we can symbolically refer to with this underscore of the function name, which then will be translated by some later phase into an actual real address for F. So in order to actually have such a mapping from name to the label and or address, we need to maintain this name in the address environment. So if we look at practical examples for functions, this might be one that comes to mind. It's a faculty function programmed in a recursive way. It needs a main function to enter the chain of recursive calls, and then we repeatedly call this faculty function even from the inside of its body, once again, faculty function. And if we think a little bit more about that, we see that during the actual execution, when we look at the machine state, we will realize that when we talk about function execution and functions to be the context, for example, for local variables or something, there might actually exist several calls of the function of the faculty function that are still not terminated at a particular point in time during execution. So, particularly for the recursive calls of faculty, there might there is still kind of context. Well, where is it? Right here. Context for that part of the faculty function still remaining in memory while the runtime needs to evaluate the call to the next instance of the faculty, which again internally has some kind of local variables, while at some point opening another call to the faculty function, which only in the very end will then collapse into at some point the program running just in the termination case, and then the whole memory structure will collapse, and all these local variable instances will be resolved into the actual result of the complete program. So what I want to say with that is that we can't just think of a function as a singular thing in memory. Instead, it will have several, or its support structures will have several instances in memory, and we need to deal with something like that. So, particularly, what differs between these instances of functions is, of course, what we have already said: the local variables. Those are, of course, different for, or potentially different for each of these instances of functions, but also the values, the formal parameters of each of those evaluate to. And so for each of the instances that are active in memory at the same time, we need to keep the values separate from the other instances. So what the idea to deal with that is that we have dedicated memory blocks for each instance of a function call. And these we will push onto the stack and use the uppermost representation for supporting our current instance of function call until we meet another function call. For that, we push onto the stack another dedicated memory area and support the new call with that until this is done. Then we remove it from the stack and go back to the last to the last support structure, and so on. These support structures or dedicated memory blocks we will call stack frames. So the purpose of this function call is to create such a stack frame for each of the other function calls that we pass. So what could be a valid stack frame for our purposes? So for that we need to talk about how to actually really in detail organize the memory for each of the functions. So since this is related to the stack, we will have the stack pointer involved in some point. So this is the top of the stack. During the execution of a function, this might grow and shrink depending on the actual evaluation. So the space that is above that thing here might be overridden. So this is kind of a taboo area for storing stack frame-related things during the actual run of the function itself. So the only point where we can put the stack frame is under the stack pointer. That's what we then actually really do. So at the beginning of the of a function call, we keep the local variables of a function right under the stack pointer. So this is where all these ij and whatever functions we have used so far will be found. And what we also need is the space where we store the formal parameters of that particular instance. So these are the things that are also stored under the stack pointer. You see that on this image we already have a few other things that are stored within this stack frame of a function, and this is has to do with kind of internal things of the virtual machine. Particularly, what we have is that in order to access these local variables, we're gonna be using indices that are specific for each of the frames. However, since it's kind of the stack pointer might be growing and shrinking, again, it's kind of very well. You can use the stack pointer to access local variables, but it's a little bit more work to do so. So we usually use a thing that we call the frame pointer, which remains always pointing to one particular cell in the stack frame and doesn't change with evaluation of expressions, so that we can use constant offsets to access local variables. So the local variables are usually indexed from zero to how many local variables you have during your function execution, and they are well, not zero, that's probably not a good thing to use here, but rather one. So they are indexed from here to from this one end to n on top of the frame pointer. Then there's, yeah?
If we have n local variables, then shouldn't we have to index n?
We have to somehow shift that, depending on. For our purposes, let's say from 1 to n plus 1 we'll see how that deals or is dealt with later on. So the frame pointer then itself points to management content, and that is particularly saved versions of the internal registers. So this fraction here is there to keep former versions of the program counter, which is in that sense kind of the continuation address after this particular function has terminated. The old frame pointer, which is a saved version of the frame pointer of the calling function, and in case that we return from our function call, we need to restore the old frame pointer to get the access to the old local variables and the old formal parameters right. Then there's also the extreme pointer, which is conceptually has to be kept different from in each instance of a function in memory, because while you call functions after functions after functions, you will increase the actual stack height to some point. And on top of the stack height, there will be the evaluation of temporary variables. So the extreme pointer, which is the one that indicates colliding with the heap pointer, might have to change during the function call. And when you terminate your function, you can safely assume or you can revert back to your former a value for the extreme pointer, because you then have worked on that particular function and you don't need that area in the stack anymore. So keep the old value of the extreme pointer also backed up in there. And that's all so far. The other part down there, we said, was the formal parameters. They are indexed in a similar way as the local variables, just in the other direction. Let's say plus one, if you keep it to starting with this n thing. So the thing is that these are also well-known indices, because the management cells that we keep there are always three by number, so we can always say where the area of the formal parameters actually really starts. So this is conceptually how we organize stack frames. These are all data that is specific to that particular thing. So a few remarks. It's maybe for people to read at home. So this is the index stuff. We've talked about that. The formal parameters are below the organizational cells and have to be addressed with negative indices, because they are going to the bottom, not to the top. So it's always like the first formal parameter will be found at minus one plus the distance that you need to incorporate for the organizational cells, which is then another minus two or something. So there's another offset added to that. Why do we keep the formal parameters separated from the local variables, you might ask? Well, there's in C this concept of that you can call a function with more actual parameters than it has defined formal parameters, which is also used for the ellipsis part of the function. So you can have arbitrarily many parameters for functions, and the whole system still works. This only works if you then can dynamically evaluate how many formal parameters you have, and for that you need an unbounded area of cells to store your formal parameters in. And if you and for that you put them to the bottom of your frame, so that your frame pointer still keeps pointing to a valid area, and you can still find locals and formals in that sense. So that is for that particular purpose. Apart from that, I think it's we have already talked about pretty much all except for the return value. For our purposes, return values are always just one cell based, so you can't return an array. I think this is also something that's, or a struct, which is also not so easily done in the source language anyway, so that is a valid simplification. So now what we need for translating code with functions is we need to do two parts. We need to generate code for the actual body of the function, which is then to be executed when a call happens, and we need to generate code for calling expressions that we might find in nested into other expressions. So there's two parts that we're going to have to tackle. So let's maybe talk a little bit more about address environments. So far we have kept them as black boxes, and these row things have been just given out of the void. For address environments, we have two kinds of variables now that we are looking a little bit more closer to that. There's the global variables. Those are the ones that are in C defined outside of any function, and they are to be used throughout the complete program. You don't have to care about stack frames or anything. They always keep the same value and such. So this is one kind. The other kind is the local variables, or I don't know who it was, but somehow one already talked about these stack variables. This is what local variables are called over here, and they are kept specific for a particular instance of a function, and thus are defined to reside inside the stack frame. In order to support these two notions of variables, we extend our address environment a little bit more in, to cover these details. So the address environment maps names not to plain addresses anymore, but to combinations of a tag and a number, the tag being either the identifier for globals or locals, so GRL, and the other one being just a number, be it positive or negative. And they, well, if it's G and some number, it's the global at address of that particular number. It's if it's a local of negative number, it is to be addressed with in its negative form relative to the frame pointer. So it can also occur as a, for example, for the plain local variables without any parameter notion to it, then it's marked as being local with a positive number, and then it's positive offset to the frame pointer. So that is the cases that we're going to see. And other than that, this is what we get from the typing phase of the compiler. So we already get these kinds of data given by the compiler. This gives us the situation that we have maybe different ideas of what particular names associated with. For example, this thing here, I guess. So this is to be seen as a complete program, starting over here where we declare a global variable I, a struct L with info and next, and then we continue with a function I that declares a pointer x and a name I, and this I is we already have seen in the past. It has been used as the name for a global variable. So now we have two notions of what this I can actually mean. In one context, it's the global variable. In the other context, it's a formal parameter of a program. So what that means is that we have to differentiate between several areas called scopes of the program. So there's this scope over here, which is opened by the function body, and throughout that particular scope, here we interpret I now mapping to the formal parameter I, which is in that sense an L and minus 2 something, second formal parameter, so minus 2 for my purposes, while as every other part of the program which doesn't redefine I will keep I mapping to the global variable I, which is in that sense coded in the address environment as G, and I think it's the first variable in that sense 1. So yeah, I think this is what I have tried to reconstruct already the slide before. So I is going to be the first global, while L has been this guy over here. This is the second global. And inside of I, we have another scope where we can redefine I, and this is now already to, incorporating the two management data structures. So this is not minus 2, but minus 4. And the X over here is local variable minus 3. And is there, I think there's no local variables. So the other things that are valid are the global variable from here. This is also visible in here. Ith has been declared as a name on global level. So this is also existing here. So it's global and symbolic address underscore ith. And yeah, the mapping for I from over here is not visible. It's shadowed by the new declaration of I. So that's it. The other thing that you might have already observed is in the pattern that we have for the organization of our stack frame, we expect that the, maybe let's draw it over here. So this is where the stack pointer is pointing. This is where the frame pointer is pointing. And the formal parameters we find growing into this direction. If they grow into this direction, we need to address them from 1 to m plus 1 in that sense. So we need to find them on the stack when we start to call this thing with the m plus 1th parameter being present at first, followed by the mth parameter, followed by m minus 1 until we at some point reach 1. So this means that we need to evaluate the parameters of a function actually from right to left. This is a thing, by the way, that is not fixed in the actual C specification by itself. It says it's implementation dependent, so this can vary from compiler to compiler, and even worse, it can vary from optimization level to optimization level. So if you play around with your C compiler, you might have some weird behavior depending on the side effects of your parameters and the order in which you support them in your parameters. But just a side remark. So for our purposes, we define the evaluation order to be from right to left, and that's, I think, also what the trivialest of all optimization levels on GCC does. So it's not uncommon to do that. Yeah, the first parameter resides directly below the organizational cells. We have seen to that. And yeah, so as the address environment for formal parameters for a prototype like this one, we see that the parameters XI are found always with marker L and are found with an offset of minus 2 to the frame pointer. And yeah, all the type sizes of the I'm actually not so sure whether there shouldn't be an other. Should oh no, I think it's okay. It's from the bottom. Yeah, it's okay. So it's actually really the index I that is needed to be there, because the address starts at the lower end and then has to cover everything that is above. So that should be correct in that sense. Okay, so this is how the address environment then looks like. So, for the inside of main, there is, I think there's no great surprises. There is one, there's been one local introduced here, and other than that, it's just the globals. So, yeah, we have, and is there a parameter? No, there's not. Ah, okay, this one was it. So, it's the two globals, I and L. There's a local K, and then there's the names of the functions in the address environment. Okay, so much about the layout, the addresses in the presence of functions. So let's talk about how calling and exiting functions works, how entering and leaving functions works. So for that part of the code generation, we want to establish two terms to talk about. So there's the term of the actual caller and the term of callee. So if F calls G, then F is the caller, G is the callee. Okay, so these are the two terms that are for that. In order to get the desired functionality, we need to implement parts of the functionality for function calls in the caller and parts in the callee. The parts in the caller are called the calling and leaving, while the parts in the callee will be called the entering and exiting parts, and are put into the callee as a kind of at the beginning of the function and are added to the end of the function. So these are the those two parts frame the actual content of the function itself. Okay, so another thing that comes from this situation where you can put arbitrarily many parameters on as actual parameters to a function call is that the space requirements for the actual parameters is a thing that can not be known during the entering or the exiting phase of the callee, but is only known by the caller. So that is why the caller itself has to do a little bit of preparation and clean up in order to prepare the stack so that the callee can start executing. So what is involved during the call of function? Well, what you need to do for sure is, first of all, you have a bunch of actual parameters that are associated with the function call, and those might not be just plain values, but might be there as expressions to evaluate. So what you need to do at first is you need to evaluate those buggers. So there's a phase of evaluating the actual parameters. We have to keep in mind that there's an ordering that we need to stick to, so we start evaluating at the right and evaluate them down to the left. So this is, by the way, still part of what the caller F has to do. So then what is done next usually is a thing that can only be indirectly triggered by this mark instruction, and this will save the current value of the frame pointer and the extreme pointer to their places in the at the moment newly constructed stack frame. So you remember after the formal parameters we have these three spaces for the management registers, so that's where the old value of the frame pointer and the extreme pointer go to. Then what needs to be at the top of the stack when the function is called is the actual address of the function that we want to call. This might be a constant, like a name, but this can also be something that is computed somehow, retrieved from memory, computed via address arithmetic or something. So this might be an arbitrary expression, and this needs to be evaluated. So that is what is done in this step over here. So this comes after the mark. This is now the generation of the start address of G. This will end up leaving just a simple value on top of the stack, which is then considered to be the address of the function to be called, so the address of the callee. And this is still within the execution part of F itself. And F then will usually trigger the newly introduced instruction call, which will then perform a few management things in the internal registers. Particularly, what it will do is it will set the new frame pointer to point to the things that it finds on top of the stack, which is, for its purposes, the newly constructed frame of the new function. It will save the current program counter, which will usually fall through to the next instruction after the call. We'll put that into our bunch of management register cells in the new frame pointer, in the new stack frame, sorry. So PC, FP, and EP end up living in the newly constructed frame, and then set the PC to the address found on top of the stack, which has been the address evaluated through the evaluation of G. So this thing over here, and this will then delegate control to the actual callee. So this is where the part of F is ended, and we continue with the part of G. And all that this now needs to do is, well, only G itself knows how many stack cells it will use. That's why it sets the new EP right after the start. This is done during the enter thing. And then it needs to allocate a little bit of memory for local variables. Within G, it's defined how many local variables there are. So this is done with the alloc thing. And then we're ready to rumble with the actual body of G, and we'll start executing this G thing. Same, we get the phase where we have successfully executed the callee. Now need to go back to the former caller of G. And this is done with two instructions that are defined here. So there's return. Return's purpose is it occurs in the or as the last instruction of a function of a callee's body. And what it does is it will store the return value somewhere in the stack frame. Particularly, this will go into the area that has been occupied by the formal parameters. It will restore the frame pointer and the extreme pointer from the versions found in the stack frame, and will then jump back into the code by writing the saved value into the PC again, and thus after return is done, the next instruction will already be the one following the method call via the call instruction in the caller. So the slide then is to be found in on the caller's side, and what the caller now does it is with a slide it will pop the actual parameters from the stack, but it doesn't simply pop them, but what it does is the first cell will still contain something useful, particularly the return value of the function. So what it does is it, while popping, it will slide down the topmost cell until all the formal parameters are popped away and keep it then as the new top of the stack value. So that's what slide does. And let me wait. I think we can still do that in that little time that we have. So let's sum up with the code that we need to generate on the caller side. So this is usually needed for translating a call expression like this one over here. So remember what we need to do is what you find over here. First of all, we need to generate code for the actual parameters, starting at the right-hand side of the parameters. So we evaluate the parameters in that direction, starting with en down to e1, generate or evaluate their code. Then we perform the saving of the frame pointer and extreme pointer. Then we generate the code for the actual address which to call before doing the call, which transfers control to the callee, which does a lot of things. But finally, at the end, we'll call return and dispatch back to this address. It has been saved during the call in the stack frame. And then we still need to remove everything that we have generated over there and replace it with what has come back as return value from the call. That's done with a slide thing. And so that's in case you haven't noticed, we have used this code R code generation scheme for the parameters, which corresponds to this R value computation, which is in that sense computing a value, so that we have generated a call by value procedure call for our language here. So I think before we go too deep into the bowels of that, we stop here and continue next time with the remainder of function call, probably the callee side. So thank you for your attention. See you tomorrow.